believe when I was 17, I met my brother's best friend. And I'm not going to say his name. I'm not comfortable with that. But I met my brother's best friend, and it was at his Air Force graduation. We just hit it off. We became best friends, and we started talking every day. And I was 17. He was 25 at the time. And we didn't do anything. We were just friends. And when I turned 18, we started dating. And then my family life got really bad. My relationship with my parents was terrible. And I kind of looked for anything to, like, get out of that situation. And he was always there. And one night he said, "Why don't you come where I'm stationed?" And I said, "Okay." And then I did. And he said, "The only way for you to stay out here is for us to get married." And I said, "Okay." And I was just doing anything that I could. I was still a kid. Anything I could to just stay out of, like, the family life and, like, everything going on at home. And I thought of him as, like, the savior. And it was great for a couple of months. Like, our marriage was good. Like, he was a good husband in the beginning. And things progressed rapidly. And I didn't really know how to handle it. So I kind of just pretended it wasn't happening. My professor explained it as, like, I was being gaslit. So I guess that means that, like, he was convincing me through other ways that it wasn't happening and that it was okay. And I was also going along with that. And it's still hard to talk about. And I try not to think about it, honestly, every single day. And it affects my relationships today as well, because I don't want to tell anybody because it's terrifying. I told my best friend when I came home after all of this happened and I divorced him. And he never spoke to me again because he thought I was lying.
I call this a violent relationship.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about the violence? You've used the word rape.
Yes.
What you've written about in the story is that the violence happened repeatedly.
Yes. It all started with the fact that I was having womanly problems, and I was not supposed to be having sex because I was just in pain all the time. Like, every time I would have sex, I would just be in pain. And this was before the rape ever started. And I went to the doctor, and he went with me, and they explained to him, like, I cannot do that because I have some sort of issue down there that I won't discuss. But I have an issue down there. Like, I couldn't have sex during that period of my life. And I felt bad because I felt like I was not giving what a wife should give. Like, you know, like, because of course I cared about him, and I wanted him to feel that kind of reassurance. And he started out as being, like, fine with it and understanding. And then one night I thought, like, we should try to have sex. And it got to the point where it hurt too much, and I told him to stop, and he wouldn't stop. And I kept telling him to stop, and then I started sobbing. And I tried to push him off of me, and he's like, "I can't stop." And I'm like, "Yes, you can. You can stop." And I tried to shove him off of me, and he wouldn't move. And he was a big guy, so I couldn't, like, I'm a little girl. Like, I'm 110. He was, like, 170. I couldn't get him off of me. He held me down, and that there was nothing else I could do.
And it happened again and
again. Again and again and again.
Over months?
Over a 5-month period. There were some nights where it didn't happen, but those nights were happy nights where I actually got sleep. My brother knew before I did, because my brother would call me all the time and just, like, talk on the phone with me. And I would be home while my ex-husband was at work. He'd be like, "Is something wrong? Something seems wrong. Like, you don't seem like yourself." And I'd be like, "No, everything's fine. Everything's fine." And I think that's a common thing for people to do, to just be like, "Everything's fine. Everything's fine," because you don't want to deal with the reality of it. Because reality is a lot more scary, and it involves healing, and it involves actually accepting that something happened to you that you can't control.
I'm talking with Kamea Pasqua. She is a college student. And Kamea, I want you to share some of the writing that you've done, and then we'll talk about how you even got to the point of being able to write this. But the first section that we're going to talk about is a little bit of that aftermath. How you how you navigated the time between incidents in that gap when something had just happened and you needed to go on, but you were still in this abusive and violent relationship.
Okay. I made myself believe that it was normal, so it became that for me, my new normal. I left the reality out on the table and never touched it, never went near it, walked by it every single day. I no longer recognized its existence. It sat there for 8 months, untouched, and much like expired food, it has begun to rot. The smell has seeped through my consciousness over the months of being unacknowledged. I crawl across a continent's length of tile to the bathtub. The last piece of normal inside me reaches out and turns on the faucet. That last piece that isn't soiled like my bed sheets. Gripping the edge of the icy porcelain, I heave myself up, and all that fear secretes onto it. I'm surprised it doesn't break on contact. But objects aren't like people. There is a formula for their destruction. For people, it's just inevitability. It's no easy task, but I throw my legs over the edge, letting my bare feet absorb the heat of the water on the bathtub floor. Then what feels like hours later, but is minutes, I stand. My legs seem to have forgotten their purpose, hands frantically clutching the wall, and eyes that can't seem to differentiate the powerful water pressure from the pressure of his persistent hands. But the warmth, he didn't have that, and I cling to that thought as I scrub my skin to the bone.
That story is titled Keep Your Mouth Shut by Kamea Pasqua. There's such a sad resignation in your writing. Did you in your mind think this was going to just go on and on, that you might never get out?
Yes. Yes and no. Like I said before, I convinced myself it wasn't real. I convinced myself that everything was fine, that we were having quote-unquote sex, even though it wasn't obviously sex, it was rape. And I just thought that that was normal. Like, that was what a wife was supposed to do because that's what I was taught. My mom always said, just give him sex and he'll shut up. Like, she actually said those things to me over and over again. And so that's how I grew up. That's, a wife is supposed to have sex with her husband. Like, this is supposed to be this way. So in a way, I thought I owed it to him. And I guess I kind of just kept trying to come to terms with that. But in the back of my mind, I always knew that it wasn't right.
But you were hurt every time.
I was hurt every time.
You didn't have a voice in it.
I didn't. And I was a million miles away from home.
What started to wake you up and made you realize you needed to get away or get out?
When I looked in the mirror, I went to the gym and nobody was there. It was just me, and it was the gym on the base. And I walk in and I see someone in the mirror and I like jump. Like I jump because I don't know who it is. And I turn around and I realize that it's me. And I walk up to the mirror and it was kind of like a scene from a movie, I feel like. And I walk up to the mirror and I see the bags under my eyes and I just look sad. And I couldn't remember the last time I looked in the mirror. It was the oddest thing. It's like I was looking in the mirror, but I wasn't the same time every day I would get ready. I was looking, but I wasn't looking. And I looked at my body and I didn't recognize my body anymore. The pressure of his body on top of mine caused like the capillaries to burst in my lower back. And it was so bad. The bruising was so bad. And I remember taking a picture of it and sending it to my mom. And I was like, I don't know what this is. In the back of my mind, I knew what it was, but I was like, oh, maybe this is from working out. Like maybe I was carrying too heavy of weights or something like that. And she's like, no, that looks like someone that's not from working out. That's not how it works. And I remember doctors asking me about it. And I remember one time going to the hospital and he came with me and they asked him to leave the room and they asked me if I felt safe at home. And inside me, I knew I should have said no, but I still said, yes, I do. He's my husband. I love him. And I look back now and I'm like, I could have said something, but I was so, I was so silenced my whole life. And I guess I just adapted to that.
That might have been your awakening, Kamea, but who actually helped you physically get out and get away? And did you press charges eventually?
I did not. I haven't told this story in full until now. I don't want to press charges, not because I believe in not pressing charges against something like this, but with like all the past things that have happened, like in politics and everything and things surrounding this topic of rape, women don't usually win. And also, I don't want my personal information so public like that. I mean, of course, in this sense, it is kind of public now, but in that sense, it almost sheds a bad light on me. And I don't like that that's how the world is in that sense. And also, personally, I just don't want to. Like, even though he ruined my life, I don't want to ruin his.
I want to clarify that you fully understand that with your story being presented at Stories on Stage,
yes,
the story becomes very public.
Yes.
And with you talking to me the way you are right now, this story is broadcast and it's online.
Yes.
And it's very public.
Yes.
Because there's a part of me that wonders how fully at, how old are you right now?
21.
And this all being fairly recent in your life, how much you really grasp what has happened and what you're living through.
I think as time goes by, I definitely grasp it more than I did the months in realizing that it happened and like really coming to terms and saying this happened. And I remember laying in bed. It was some random night when I had come home, when I had flown home right after the divorce. I hadn't written in so long, and I used to write all the time. And I opened up my laptop and I didn't know what to write. And I laid back in bed and I looked up at the ceiling. And for some reason, I said it out loud. I said, I was raped. And I started crying. And I hadn't cried in years. And it was freeing, also terrifying, but it was freeing in a way that I could accept it in at least a small percentage. I have lots of friends that I talk to about it now. I have professors that I can talk to about it as well, which is very nice. The professor who pushed me to publish this and put it out there and stuff, he's been a great friend to me, honestly. And he's actually best friends with another professor that I am now close friends with. And they're both wonderful people, Josh Fernandez and David Lacey. They're both wonderful people, and I think they've been there for me indirectly and directly in the way of this assignment turning into this, and also just being good professors and listening when I need them to listen and talking when I need them to talk to fill the silence. And my friends also, they've been extremely supportive. And I can't talk about it with my family. My family doesn't really know. My mom knows because I say that in the piece, but my mom and my brother know. But other than that, nobody else knows.
Was there a fight in you being able to leave or wanting to leave your ex-husband?
There was a fight, not a violent one. It was more verbal. I remember it vividly, actually. I woke up one Sunday morning and it was pouring rain outside, and I look over at him and I'm like, I'm leaving you. And he looks over at me and he starts crying. And I was so confused by that. I kind of just stared at him and I was like, I don't think we're in a healthy relationship and I need to go. And he didn't want to let me go, and he grabbed onto my arm and I said, no, I need to go. I already bought my plane ticket. I need to leave. And he said, we can work on things, we can fix things, we can do whatever you want. And I said, no, and he was still crying. And he kept trying to talk to me, and I said, no, I am leaving. And he said, can I take you to the airport? And I said, no, I am leaving. So, me being dumb, I agreed to let him take me to the airport. He did take me to the airport. And I got there on time, checked in my bags, and he asked me to promise him that I would come back, thinking that we were in love. And I said, sure. And I fake cried. And I walked away, and I just remember being able to breathe. And it was like, there was a quote I saw somewhere. It was like, I breathed your toxic air for so long that fresh air doesn't seem fresh anymore. And once I passed the security check, I could breathe. And he was already calling me past that. And I declined it and I blocked him. I went to Vegas. I got the divorce, sent him the papers. He signed them, sent them back. But yeah, that's how I left.
You said the end of the piece is
one of my favorite parts, yes.
Yeah. Would you read the end of the piece, please?
Of course. A professor once told me to trust myself more. He, of course, was referring to my constant apologies for feeling like I didn't understand a chapter, even though I wrote an immaculate summary of it. He didn't know, but this advice reached me on a different level. I feel like I'm always saying the wrong thing. I think I never really have something valuable to add to a conversation. I think that I will never sound as intellectual or culturally diverse as someone else. There's always a smarter person in the room. But I also feel this way about events in my life. When I was being raped, I didn't believe it. I told myself it didn't happen because I thought that maybe somewhere in those experiences, I had said yes. I had wanted it, and my mind just twisted things in a way that made it seem different. I'm one of those people who used to believe that pain needed to physically show for it to be real and recognized. I don't just mean cuts and bruises. I mean mental illnesses as well. I'm afraid that there is something wrong with me for not having a mental illness after experiencing something as traumatic as that. It seems like every day I'm just waiting to fall apart. I never do. It's like my body is incapable of it. I feel the feeling surface when someone talks about abuse, so I rush to the bathroom hoping for tears. But all I get is a crystal clear view of a black stall door littered with carved words, wondering when it will happen or if I'm doomed to feel everything and nothing at all.
At the beginning of this conversation, I asked you to tell me a bit about your life. But if you feel a little more willing to share some of the inner terrain, who are you now inside and what vision do you have for your life?
The aftermath is, I think, the hardest part. The during is terrible, but you just have to survive. And then the aftermath is the hardest part because you have to accept that it happened and you have to accept that there is nothing you can do to change it. And you have to keep going every single day and you have to keep accepting yourself even though this terrible thing happened. And I think that is the hardest part. But I still have hope for my future. I still strive for things. I'm still part of the newspaper club. I'm still part of the literary magazine. I still love writing. I'm still me. I'm just me with some traumatic experiences that affect me subconsciously and consciously. But I feel a lot more free with this out to the public, because it's almost like it's not a dirty secret I'm hiding anymore.